Did you know you can save up to 70% on the best brands just by shopping at FromRebel.com? We're talking about strollers, car seats, high chairs, espresso machines, cookware, everything you need for way less. Here's how it works. Every single day, Rebel drops thousands of new products on the site for up to 70% off. It is a constant stream of endless deals from top brands like Upa Baby, Nuna, Baby Bjorn, Breville, Nespresso, KitchenAid, Le Creuset, and more. But you have to act fast because every deal is one of a kind. So if you see something you love, make sure you add to cart fast. So stop paying full price when you don't have to. Whether it's baby gear, kitchen upgrades, or a treasure for your home you didn't know you needed, Rebel has it for way less, up to 70% less. Shop from Rebel.com and save big.
We're all in this together. And this is a fight for so much more than profits for partner. This is a fight for democracy. This is a fight for the rule of law. And some people just don't give a shit, and that makes me angry.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All. To Sarah, I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Bulwark, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law to explain the legal news to me.
The illegal news to me.
I got to put that in the intro so that I remember to say it.
It's got to be illegal. I want to change the title of the podcast for that. Illegal news, the outrageous and illegal news as we track the decimation of the rule of law.
That's true. Although, you know, it's interesting because the legal news now is almost, what would it be? It's like it's explicit in that we are actually covering lawyers who are the legal infrastructure and watching them cave in real time to this autocrat. And I know that you talked about this with JVL and that it's been covered a lot on this podcast.
I even did a special podcast with Tim, I think.
With Tim. I know. And it was super
emergency
good.
Podcast.
And it deserved an emergency podcast because,
it is an emergency.
It is an emergency. And I know listeners of this podcast understand this about how significant it is to watch sort of the capitulation and cowardice from these big law firms. But I just, as a refresher from your conversation last week, Paul Weiss was the first firm to cave, but then Perkins Coie, Jenner and Block, and
Perkins Coie and Jenner and Block, to their credit, they fought.
No, I know. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. I said Paul Weiss was the first firm to cave, but Perkins Coie, Jenner and Block, and Wilmer Hale, they all pushed back and are litigating, right, the executive orders targeting them. And so I was hoping that the Jenner and Wilmer sort of standing strong would have encouraged other firms to fight. But then just recently, again, Skadden caved. And then this week, so did Wilkie Farr and Milbank. So what's the latest on the Perkins, Jenner, and Wilmer litigation? Like, where does that stand?
Well, the Perkins Coie litigation is proceeding apace. It's the first one to proceed. And I think it's going to determine all the other cases. I think it's a no-brainer. As you may recall, a couple of weeks ago, there was a TRO hearing in front of Judge Howell here in the District of Columbia. And now that is the next stage in that litigation is she's going to decide a motion for summary judgment and whether to give a permanent injunction to Perkins Coie. And I think it's pretty clear that she's going to do that. Her TRO basically indicated that they had the better of it on the merits. And I think that's not going to change. I myself participated in the submission of an amicus brief on behalf of various people. And then there was another great amicus brief filed this morning on behalf of 363 law professors. I mean, I notwithstanding the fact that some of these law firms are caving, and I think there's a particular reason for that that I can get into, I think the legal profession actually is horrified, collectively horrified by what's been happening. And I think most lawyers in the country feel the same way that I do. The ones that I've been talking to certainly do. They may not be in a position or they may not be the spotlight of focus, but I think on balance, the lawyers feel very strongly about this.
And then I want to talk about the downstream consequences will be that these firms won't take on clients, right, who are being investigated by Congress or the DOJ, Like that is one of the things that will happen as a result of this.
Yes and no. Because I think there's been an interesting dichotomy between the firms that have capitulated and the firms that have not capitulated, and indeed firms that have basically taken a strong stance even though they have not yet been targets. The firms that have capitulated are the New York firms with mergers and acquisitions and other transactional practices that they're very, very lucrative. I worked at one of the leading M&A law firms for 30 years, Wachtell, Lipton, Rosen & Katz. And, you know, I know the business. And the business basically is a business where if you represent, you're doing corporate work and you're representing a company in a transaction, the firm gets a percentage of the transaction value as a fee, but doesn't get paid if there is no deal. It's purely contingent work that depends on whether the deals are going through. So the law firms are paid like the investment banks. They're incentivized to get the deals through, although they get a smaller percentage than, you know, the Goldman Sachs and the Citigroups or whatever, whoever the bankers are of the world. And the problem for these firms, and this is not an excuse, is that if all of these deals that tend to be done these days are strategic deals, in other words, deals within a particular industry. I mean, back in the 60s, there used to be conglomerate deals where companies would think that if they got into 50 different businesses, they'd thrive when in fact they ended up not knowing how to work the other 49 businesses. In this environment, all of the mergers, or a vast majority of the mergers, are subject to either antitrust or regulatory scrutiny. In other words, they have to go to the government to confirm that they can merge or confirm that they complete their deal. And the fear, I think, that's driving these capitulations is that the firms will be jeopardized in their transactional business, which is the most lucrative of all their businesses because of the nature of how much they get paid. They fear that they aren't going to be able to get their deals past government regulators, past the United States Department of Justice, past the Federal Trade Commission, which Trump is trying to control by trying to fire members of the FTC. And also there are, you know, there's the FCC, which is no great shakes with that guy Carr running it. There are all sorts of, and there's, in some cases, there could be CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, which is also controlled by the executive branch, and basically cabinet members are a member, including the Secretary of State and Secretary of Treasury. So there are a lot of reasons why, if you're trying to get a deal done, or you're an investment banker, or you're a private equity firm, you might hesitate to hire a law firm that Trump has targeted. It's a form of extortion, a grotesque form of extortion. So that's the bad news. And I'm still going to be critical of firms that are capitulating to Trump, although I understand the economics of it. The good news is that most firms do not have that kind of practice. The Wilmer Cutler, Williams and Connolly, which was representing Perkins Coie. Perkins Coie, to a large extent, although Perkins Coie has a lot of government contracting businesses. Jenner and Block. There are a lot of law firms out there that do not rely on this New York-style Wall Street business, and they will not be capitulating. And I hope they will not be capitulating. And I think there is kind of, you know, I don't like to attribute intelligence to the evilness of the Trump administration, but there is an intelligence involved here. It's not Donald Trump's. It's probably Stephen Miller's that's being applied to select these targets. So the good news, the bad news is that, you know, the Paul Weisses of the world have caved. I think Paul Weiss in particular is particularly objectionable because they really, really opened the door to this to all their other competitors in New York. And also I criticize Sullivan Cromwell, where I've spoken about, you know, my friend, the best man at my wedding, who's representing Donald Trump in his criminal case and has been actually involved in some of these discussions involving the other law firms. I think it's absolutely reprehensible. And, you know, there is a dynamic here where I think a certain kind of law firm will cave. And I think there's a dynamic, and this is putting an optimistic spin on, where other law firms will stand up to Trump.
Yeah, although it's sort of depressing.
The problem is that Trump is self-selecting the ones he thinks will cave.
Yeah, I think that's it's important to understand why the law firms are unique among other people. Because like the M&A elements of like Paramount or Disney capitulating is there too, right? Like that is why media companies, big tech companies, like they all have this kind of business in front of the federal government.
They all have transactions, but they, you know, I mean, the whole media industry, and I, as somebody who, I cut my teeth as a M&A litigator in 1989 and 1993 on Time merging with Warner and then Paramount trying to take over Time. I mean, it's, you know, there has been just this endless rearrangement in the media industry of, you know, method channels of distribution and sources of content. And it's just, you know, they've never quite seemed to have gotten it right. It's never been stable. And the one thing you have seen and are continuing to see today, particularly with the change from linear television to streaming, is this continual rearrangement and chaos and continual transactions, which is great for the media M&A bankers and great for the law firms, not so great for some of the people who work in the industries, but it also makes them hostages to Donald effing Trump. And
well, they are
gives
really
him a lot of power
degree,
that he,
but yeah.
Even he is smart enough to know that he can exercise.
Yeah. Okay. I want to get to something that I saw that was sort of particular to you, which is, and I'm just going to set this up by saying the full name of Paul Weiss is Paul Weiss Rifkin, Wharton, and Garrison. And two of Judge Rifkin's granddaughters. So these are like the scion of the firm, wrote a letter to the firm's chairman. And I just want to read a few excerpts from it. As two of the four granddaughters of Judge Simon Rifkin, both of us practicing lawyers, we have been following the Trump administration's attack on Paul Weiss and the legal profession closely. Amid our heartbreak about the assault on rule of law in our country and the executive order targeting Paul Weiss, you traveled to Washington to surrender before you had even begun to fight. To support your agreement with the administration, you cited in a memorandum to the firm our grandfather's 1963 statement of principles for Paul Weiss to support your decision. We were utterly stunned. It is plain to us, as it would have been to our grandfather, that taking action to stay off an enemy's list does not advance the rule of law as embodied in the statement of principles. It undercuts it, and it emboldens those who seek to dismantle it. As you face other decisions going forward, unless you prioritize your responsibilities, both to our profession and our country, and redevelop muscle and determination to protect the prizes of our civilization, we request that you cease invoking our grandfather's name to justify your actions. And finally, we implore you to support publicly the law firms that are opposing governmental attacks for the clients they advise and the attorneys they hire, and to defend the erosion of the rule of law in courts.
Yeah. I'm going to get moist-eyed here because when I first read that letter yesterday, I got moist-eyed. It was just a magnificent letter. And to really give you the context of this, Simon Rifkin was a founder of the Paul Weiss firm, a major builder of the firm, obviously, as his name is in the firm's name. And he became a very, you know, one of the legendary, revered United States district judges in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York, which I think, I mean, maybe it's just my personal parochialism, was really the great, one of the greatest district court with the most amazing history of all of the 88 or 90 district courts in the country. And he's one of a handful of judges who are just revered. And when I first heard of the Paul Weiss capitulation, I started texting and calling a friend of mine who's a former Paul Weiss partner. I can say who she was. It's Robbie Kaplan, which is the one guest we've had on this program. And one of the things she immediately sent me as a Paul Weiss alumna was this set of principles that Judge Rifkin had written for the firm eons ago. And, you know, I immediately put it out on social media just to basically say, this is what they are disgracing. I mean, I even think I went to the point of saying, if they're going to, you know, they should show some respect for Judge Rifkin by taking his name off the door. I mean, it's just outrageous. He would just absolutely, I mean, a man like that. I mean, these are the people who founded these big law firms. I mean, particularly, this was a law firm founded by Jews when the Jews weren't allowed to work at the other firms, right? So, you know, there was a belief when they made these firms, when they created these firms, in not just making money, not just doing well, but being craftsmen, being part of a profession, being professionals and being committed to the rule of law, being committed to the betterment of the society in which they live. And the Paul Weiss thing was just, it was, if you had to pick a firm in that city with a, you know, with the reputation of, you know, it still lived off that reputation of Judge Rifkind. I mean, you know, it's, you know, it was just a complete abdication of that. And for Brad Karp, I know him personally, I just can't believe it, but I guess I believe the economics of it, to cite those principles in this capitulation, in this context, was just, I mean, it was appalling to anybody who knows anything about the practice of law in the city of New York, the history of its law firms, and to the people who have been affiliated and associated with Paul Weiss, of which there are many associates and former partners and children and grandchildren of members and of the firm, as we'll get to. It's just staggeringly appalling. And so when I read that letter, I was just moved by it, because it really conveyed everything in a way that, you know, from a moral platform, these granddaughters of this amazing lawyer, judge, mensch, whatever you want to call him. You know, this is what it's about. Not that third house and the second house in the Hamptons or whatever it is that these people seem to be striving for these days. And I went so far, actually, yesterday to send one of the granddaughters a note. I don't know these women, but I looked them up. I looked one up who's a lawyer here in D.C. at Arnold and Porter, and I sent her an email saying, "Bravo, thank you." And it turned out she sent it to her sister, who's a solo practitioner in, of all places, Mississippi. It's a long way from Midtown Manhattan, but she's in, and her sister's Nina sent me a note saying, you know, it wasn't a hard choice to do, and we're not publicly facing person, but we felt very strongly about it. And she said she listened to our podcast.
I know. I saw it. It's great.
And I was like, you know, that also was very moving, because, you know, she wants to feel, they want to stand up for something. People want to stand up for something. And I wanted them to know people are listening to them. And it was good to know that people are listening to us. We're all in this together. And this is a fight for so much more than profits for partner. This is a fight for democracy. This is a fight for the rule of law. And some people just don't give a shit. And that makes me angry. But to see these granddaughters of Judge Rifkind, the eloquence of their words was really profoundly moving. Sorry.
That's okay. I think that part of what sometimes gets lost in the fights that we're having in the political moment is the fact that one of the things that drives you into this space is that, like, we really cared about certain values, both as conservatives, for you as a legal professor, for me as somebody who believed in what America stands for, you know, pluralism and free speech and the rule of law, and being raised to profoundly care about those things, to think that they mattered, and to have the people who I tweeted about something like this the other day, because, you know, I was raised up in sort of institutional conservative environments. Like I worked at a conservative think tank after college and have been sort of around the conservative movement, but Heritage and all of the groups, like I went to all these talks at all these places where they talked about the Constitution and all of these values, free markets, you know, for example. And like it is disorienting and genuinely heartbreaking when the people that you listened to who helped you develop your values abandon them all so quickly. Cause you're like, yeah. Well, wait a second. I genuinely did this. Cause I think this is a, like I, you know, you join the legal profession and they hit you with, I have a lot of really good friends who are lawyers. They hit you with a lot of like, this is a revered profession. Yeah. You have a real role that you play in society. Yeah. There are these invisible lines that you help maintain for the Constitution.
No.
And then to have everybody just act then like it doesn't matter at all.
Friends.
Is bizarre.
Spouses. You know, it's it hurts. It really, really hurts. I mean, you think that at some point, I get it. You get carried away, and you're on Team Republican, and maybe you're on Team MAGA for a while. But at some point, do you just have to take a step back and just say, "How did we get here? I've done something wrong," and not enough people have done that, and it really. And when it's people that you know, it's really, really hard. It still bothers me. It's the thing about Trumpism that will bother me till the day I die, is that how could you do this? I mean, at some point, is it worth it? How can you look yourself in the mirror? And I get it. I mean, I get it. I mean, yeah, you have objections to this, that, and the other thing. Maybe there are policy, immigration, so on and so. But that's, you don't want to take people off the street with no due process, blindfold them, shove them on planes, and send them to an El Salvador prison where they can be tortured, and nobody knows whatever happens to them. And the government says, whatever. What's the difference between that and sending them on the trains eastbound? What is that? How can you justify that? How can you live with that? I mean, even Joe Rogan the other day was saying, I don't know if I like this. And Ann Coulter, you know, I mean, it's like, but people are just saying, you know, people are just going out there and pretending it's all okay because it doesn't affect them. And pretending, well, we don't really know. Maybe they are criminals. Maybe are. It's like, that's not America.
Many of them... Very well, maybe. And you know what? When you establish that, by all means, feel free to deport them. If they are gang members of MS-13 and they are convicted of that and they are in the country illegally.
I mean, I don't know if you send them for an indefinite detention in an El Salvadoran prison.
Sure.
But, yeah. You know, but yeah, at least before you send them abroad
but
and
like,
send them back.
What's crazy right now is that it seems they have admitted that they're making mistakes. And some of the cases they've admitted it, and others, it's like pretty clear they have. Like the gay makeup artist, I mean, I don't know, maybe he's Trinidad Agua, the gay makeup artist, but like, I don't know. They don't care about getting them back. Like, this is one of those things that I cannot fundamentally understand.
Yeah.
J.D. Vance is out there slugging away.
You label them criminals on what grounds? Who made that determination? A bunch of ICE agents who are basically checking for tattoos that may or may not have anything to do with gang members and are just trying to meet a quota. We don't even know. I mean, you know, for all we know, you could just take a citizen off the street, and then by the time they're gone, nobody will have had a chance to sue. And then once they're in El Salvador, government says no control.
Hey, wait, I have a question about that, actually. This is not in my list of topics, but we were talking about this on The Next Level yesterday. Isn't it true? So a lot of these guys have protected status in some way, but they're not American citizens.
Right.
As an American citizen, because I've heard other people say what you just said, which is they could start just doing this to American citizens.
Right.
Is that true? Can they do it to an American citizen? If you're on foreign soil, you're still an American citizen.
They shouldn't be able to do this legally to anyone. But if you're not giving people process, if you're not giving people due process and you're not really checking your boxes, there's nothing to stop them from doing it to an American citizen. They're doing things to lawful permanent residents, people with green cards. You can't, take that status away without an adjudication. And the point is if you're just throwing people on planes, and obviously the Alien Enemies Act does not apply to, it does not allow the arrest and deportation of American citizens by virtue of the fact that it only applies to aliens. But the government is basically saying it applies even though there's no war, which is also a requirement. No invasion, which is also a requirement. So if the government has this ability to just send people abroad with no due process, and they're saying that the government, that the judge can't stop them, these people, what's to stop the government from just randomly picking people off the street because they have a tattoo and a brown skin? They could have a passport. Doesn't, you know, there's nothing. There's just, you know, we have reached the bottom. We have reached the point where, you know, there's nothing that stops the government from doing this if it wants to do it. At least that's the government's position.
Okay, we took a detour there on immigration, but yeah. I'm glad we covered it because I had been thinking about that question. I want to go though. We were just talking about selling out the values of being a Republican, being a conservative, being a lawyer. But it's funny, free trade, one of those values. And as you may know, we are taping this on Trump's Liberation Day, which I like to think of as
Liberation Day plus one.
Yeah. Oh, that's right. Sorry. Liberation Day plus one. But it is the day the markets are reacting to Donald Trump's tariffs. The markets are crashing as we speak. They continue to drop. But I went and looked at a bunch of Republicans talking about tariffs. It doesn't even have to be that long ago, because like Elise Stefanik put out a statement today about how much she supports Donald Trump's America First agenda with the tariffs. And like from 2018, you can find all these quotations from her being like, tariffs are a tax on Americans. They're bad. They're going to hurt the, you know, businesses here in upstate New York. But I want to talk about the legality of the Trump imposed tariffs, right? Because he's imposing the tariffs under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is a 1977 statute that gives the president wide powers to address national emergencies. So what's your take on the legality of the tariffs?
Well, I confess, I have not read that statute. It's one of the many, you know, things, potentially illegal things that I should be reading more about, but it's hard to keep up. I have to say just offhand that I'm skeptical because what emergency is there with regard to, you know, Diego Garcia? which is this British outpost in the middle of the Indian Ocean, which Trump has imposed tariffs on, which whose only occupants are Americans at a U.S. military base that the U.S. rents from Britain. And then there's this uninhabited island they impose tariffs on that contains no life but penguins and whatever it is.
I love those tariff paying penguins.
Whatever fish it is they eat. Yeah. It can't be that there's an emergency there. And it can't be that there's an emergency around the world that didn't exist 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago or 2 years ago or 6 years ago when he was president. I mean, what's different today? I mean, I can understand Congress as a policy matter giving the president the power to respond to immediately to circumstances. Let's say that some country that exports something to us that's vital raises, you know, or imports something from us, starts a tariff war with us. We should be able to respond. So, yeah, but none of that is the case. And none of it makes any sense because, you know, we found out last night, people were trying to figure out where did they get these fucking numbers from for each of these particular countries, including the ones that are just rocks in the middle of the Indian Ocean. Where did they get these numbers from? And it turned out it has nothing to do with the tariffs that these countries or the legal barriers that these countries may or may not, in many cases, do not place on American goods. Frankly, if you look at the degree to which there is trade freedom among countries, we don't rank very high. I mean, we're like way down, like 30 or 40 down on the list. You know, but basically they're just deciding that if you have a trade deficit with us, you must be engaging in unfair trade practices. But it could just be that, you know, the people of country X just make something that we just don't make. Or they can dig something out of the ground there that we don't, that we need, that we can't dig out of the ground in Minnesota. Okay? And that's why we have free trade. They have a comparative advantage. So we can buy stuff from them, and then they can use the cash back and buy stuff from us. If we don't have something they want, well, they can buy, they can exchange the currency for somebody else, and somebody else can buy from us. All right? It doesn't, you know, it's got, what they've done here has nothing to do with the fairness of trade. They're just arbitrarily slapping these, you know, and these numbers are insane. 54% tariff on Chinese goods. You have any, I mean, that's insane. I mean, who, you know, obviously we have issues with the Chinese. Okay. I mean, I do. I mean, how they treat the Uyghurs, how they treat their own people, and so on and so forth. But are Americans really going to want to pay more for their iPhones?
Let's see. You know,
and let's see. And Amazon. Oh, yeah. Jeff Bezos making nice to the administration. Well, you know, half the shit that you buy on Amazon says made in China. All right. Let's see how that works out for Jeff. Let's see if the free markets newspaper, op-ed page. Let's see how they take this.
Oh, you know what? You brought up this is a great point that I wanted to actually ask you about earlier when we were talking about the M&A stuff. Part of what's crazy about all this to me, everybody capitulating and is like nobody's actually getting the things they wanted out of their transactions with the Trump administration.
Right. Like you made the point this morning on Twitter when you said, "Oh, let's see how the anti-antis are doing." I made the point similarly this morning when I basically said, "Let's see all these, you know, there's a certain element of MAGA that occupies the country clubs and the Wall Street halls, the trading bros. Okay. They were great. They're all great. They're all for MAGA, not because they give a fuck about some of the stuff that people in Nebraska care about.
Right.
But they, you know, they want their marginal tax rate lower and they want their taxes lowered. They want their, you know, the capital gains tax lower. The people in Silicon Valley want the whatever it is, the carry whatever.
Carried interest,
right? Yep. They want their carried interest deductions. And it's like, this man imposes the basically probably the largest tax increase in gross in the history of the human race. I mean, it's hilarious. And then to go back to the law firms, connected up to the law firms, these fucking law firms that caved and the ones that are sucking up to Trump by representing him, my friend's firm, you know, they're doing that because they want to be at the center of power so the Wall Street will know where to go to handle Donald Trump. But Wall Street ain't going to be real happy with Donald Trump now.
Yeah.
So let's see where it gets you. I mean, it's if it weren't so destructive of the country's prosperity, there'd be some schadenfreude about it.
Yeah, I mean, look, obviously, I do not like to see
the country destroyed.
Our country destroyed. but also, like, he said he was going to do tariffs.
Yes!
Like, part of the reason that I just have no sympathy for these people is, like, Kamala Harris said she was going to build houses, and he said he was going to impose tariffs. Right. And you were like, we're not going to believe what she's saying, and we're also not going to believe what Trump is saying. We're just going to impose our own, like, fantasies on this stuff. And
He's a businessman.
Oh, yeah, sure. He understands.
He's a businessman. I mean, let's leave apart the fact that he bankrupted several casinos.
He's a crappy businessman.
Crappy businessman who basically, you know, the reason why he was able to survive is because he had this cash cow bequeathed to him in trust from his dad. Well, all these, you know, if you come up from Kennedy Airport, you see all these tenement buildings, and it's like, that's where all the money came from.
Thanks, Brad.
Saved him multiple times. And the other thing too is, from my standpoint, and maybe, you know, I guess one of the few saving graces I get to say I told you so, is this is fucking nuts.
Yeah.
Okay? I've been saying for how many years now? 6 years, 7 years, that this guy is cuckoo? This is cuckoo. Okay? This is nuts. I mean, even The Economist unloaded with a tweet today of its front cover, which showed that Donald Trump is standing on a on basically a manhole shaped by the, or some kind of a cutout shaped by the United States, sawing the floor out from under him, and said that everything that Trump said in his speech yesterday was utterly deluded. I can say it with a British accent. That's what they said. Utterly deluded. And it was.
It is deluded.
The history, the economics, it was delusional. This, he's nuts.
And this is the part.
It's kind of nice to be able to, you know, I have to say, it's like all you fucking people, you anti-antis and you Wall Street types and all you people who said, oh, he doesn't mean it. He's just saying this stuff. He's just, you know, he's just lying, which he does. No, no, no. He's actually fucking nuts. He is a liar. He's an absolutely brazen, pathological liar. But sometimes he tells you what he really wants to do. And just because it sounds crazy doesn't mean he doesn't want to do it, because he is, in fact, fucking crazy.
Yeah. And this is where it's not, it's less I told you so in Schadenfreude and more like, sorry, guys, you need to touch the stove. Like, you're going to, you're just going to have to deal with the consequences of what happened. And also, I want Trump to be a failure. Because I want people to see how damaging he is, right? Yeah. Like I, and so this.
Look, if these people want to put their hands on the stove, let's turn the heat up.
Yeah,
so get like, it over with. Yep.
The sooner we understand how dangerous Donald Trump is, and people, the regular Americans, understand it, like the sooner we can start getting ourselves out of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
It didn't do us any good to have a bunch of adults at the table the first time around protecting Donald Trump from himself and protecting us from Donald Trump, because all that did was make it so people were willing to elect him again.
Make it passable. That's right. Make it normal. No, I mean, we needed, I mean, it was, we, I don't know, I mean, maybe you, I had these debates 6-7 years ago. It's like whether everybody should just quit, right? And the argument on one side was, we can't, you know, people need to show how awful this is. They have to quit. They have to take a stand. And then the other one was, okay, but if everybody quits, who's going to keep him in check? Right? Remember that debate?
Yes.
It's like, the reason why we're still at this is because nobody quit when they should have.
Yeah.
We actually needed him to take the country to hell in a handbasket faster.
Now, and he did it plenty with COVID, but people didn't realize how much.
He did plenty with COVID, and that's what got him, that's what got us a 4-year respite.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, some, you know, it really is. It's like what I wrote in The Atlantic the day after the election. It's like, okay, sometimes, you know, essentially we have to learn the hard way, and people are going to learn, and that's what's happening. And it's sad, but, you know, I guess every generation or every second or third generation has to go through some hell that's created, that they created for themselves.
That's right. Okay, let's just, I've got sort of a popcorn of other things I wanted to ask you about real quick before it gets too late. One is, last time, since we last talked, or even since you talked to JVL, Donald Trump was on NBC. He was talking to Kristen Welker over the weekend and said he's not joking about running for a third term. And then, okay, so a bunch of us were like, okay, this guy is actively like trying to come up with some legal schematic for how he could do this, whatever. And there was this chastening from some of the conservative circles, like an Eric Erickson type, who says, you guys don't even trust our Constitution. This is just libs freaking out over nothing. Again, totally letting Donald Trump off the hook for trying to get a third term. But they're saying, like, there's no way he could do this. What is your...
Yeah, I mean, I have expressed this view both on CNN and MSNBC to the shock of many, but it is theoretically possible for him to serve a third term. And the reason is that the language of the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which we all think of as restricting the president to two terms, it's actually not up to the task. It says, no person shall be elected more than twice to the office of president. And it also says no person shall be elected more than once to the office of president if he has served more than 2 years of some term to which somebody else was elected. That doesn't apply here. He could serve as president if he were not elected president.
And he just canceled elections?
Here's the hypothetical. And then I'm going to give you, there's a counter argument, which I don't think is all that strong, but at least it exists. Here's what you would do. You would have somebody, some shill, run as president, and he would be the vice president on the ticket, and the ticket would win, and then Donald Trump would be the elected vice president. He would be elected by the Electoral College as vice president. And then what would happen would be that the person who was elected president would either disclaim the office, essentially resign before January 20th, or resign after being sworn in on January 20th. And then, by operation of the 25th Amendment, Donald Trump would become president of the United States again. And that would not violate the 22nd Amendment because he would not have been elected president a third time. And I know that sounds technical, but literally that's what these provisions say. And you could argue that I'm being too literal, but I'm not. I mean, look, I'm a conservative. I believe when the text says something, it means what it says. And it's not only that, if you go into legislative history, which, you know, Scalia types like me don't like to do, the legislative history just makes it worse because the original, I mean, there were law review articles written about this 20, 30 years ago, way before Trump. The original proposal in the House of Representatives before they drafted the 22nd Amendment and ultimately proposed it and sent it to the states actually did use the words hold the office and serve the office. Instead, they chose elected. Okay? They could have used language that could have foreclosed this screwy scenario, but they did not. And I'm not the only person who agrees. I mean, you know, Larry Tribe agrees with this. All right? Larry Tribe texted, and I texted with him, and he tweeted, you know, that this actually could work. And, you know, it's like his view, he has a much more expansive way of interpreting the Constitution than I would adopt. But his point is pretty simple. You know, he believes in kind of a living constitution the way Brennan did, but that's when you're interpreting clauses that are open textured, like due process, equal protection, right? Their view is that when people wrote those clauses, they meant that these concepts would develop over time because they are so open textured. They don't define themselves. The courts over time will develop new ways of understanding due process and new ways of equal protection, new concepts of equal protection as society evolves and circumstances evolve. You don't have to buy into that. This is just a purely, there's nothing open textured about this. This is simple language of, you know, A, B, C. There is no mystical language here to be interpreted mystically. It's a simple direction, and they chose these words. And that's a problem. Now, the counter argument is that there is a sentence in the 12th Amendment, which is the amendment that was enacted after the screw up in the 1800 election that it's not worth getting into, but it basically says that no person shall be elected vice president or no person shall be elected vice president if they do not meet the qualifications of president. So the argument is, okay, the person under the 22nd Amendment, Trump would not be qualified to be president because he had been elected twice and therefore would not be qualified to be vice president, so he could not be elected vice president, problem solved. The problem is that's question begging. And this is in the true sense. People misuse the word question begging. You're assuming the conclusion about what the 22nd Amendment means, that it means that he's disqualified from serving as president, but that's not what it says. Okay? It doesn't say he's disqualified from serving. It says he's disqualified from being elected. Mm-hmm. And so, to my mind, the 12th Amendment, maybe this is getting too deep into it, the 12th Amendment doesn't add anything to the 22nd Amendment. You still have to get the answer from the 22nd Amendment, which says that somebody could, as I read it, the straightforward text of it, as I read it, that means that somebody could become president during a third term as long as they were not elected to that job. And that is what Trump is talking about, clearly. Somebody has whispered this in his ear. Now, that being said, you know, I think the Constitution may not save us. Cheeseburgers may on this one, but we'll see. I think we got a long way to go. I mean, I again, in 2021, you and I, and we all felt like, you know, this guy, he could come back. I don't know whether he's going to be able to come back this time after destroying the world economy and at his age. That said, you know, I guess maybe the solution would be you or I could run as president and we'd have Barack Obama, you know, we'd have to register as Democrats for once, and we could have Barack Obama as vice president and we could cede the job to Barack Obama, and we could have an Obama-Trump surrogate race. It's crazy, but this is where we are.
Yeah, Cuban.
No, even talking about this is insane.
Cuban, but Obama does seem like the answer to Vance Trump.
Yeah.
But okay, just as a last matter before we jump out of here, there was a resolution this week in the Eric Adams corruption prosecution, meaning the case was dismissed with prejudice. What does that mean?
All right. So what happened here was the Trump administration corruptly decided to let Adams go because Adams had been sucking up to Trump. And also professing to be, I want to help your immigration efforts, which he could do anyway, regardless of whether or not he was indicted. And so the government moved the main justice, directed the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York to dismiss the prosecution against Adams without prejudice, meaning that, you know, the charges could be brought again. The people in the U.S. Attorney's Office, and we've discussed this, basically said, what? This is insane. Like, we got this guy. He's a bad guy, and this is like you're making a corrupt deal with him. And they quit. And then they tried to get people from the people at Maine Justice were unhappy, and it ended up that the highly detestable Deputy Attorney General Emile Bove had to go down and go up to New York and argue for the dismissal. And what happened was the judge, very smartly, appointed as an amicus curiae, which courts can do. They can, you know, what happens is when both sides are advocating for a position, Adams obviously wanted the case dismissed, as did the government, so they weren't opposing the motion. A court can actually appoint a lawyer to act as amicus curiae to present the other side. And the lawyer, Judge Ho, appointed Paul Clement, one of the greatest Republican conservative Federalist Society advocates, probably the greatest one ever. He was Solicitor General during the second Bush administration, George W. Bush administration. Probably the best living Supreme Court advocate, and most respected by the Supreme Court, appointed him to submit a brief, and he submitted a brief, and the brief made the point: look, you can't make the Justice Department prosecute a case it doesn't want to prosecute. It's not the job of the court to do that, because it really is an Article II function, not an Article III function. And the Article III, you can't tell the Justice Department what to do in that way. That being said, there is this stench of corruption. I'm using my own words here, by virtue of the fact that the dismissal sought by the government is a non-prejudicial dismissal. In other words, they could bring the charges again. So it looks like there's a corrupt deal where you do what we tell you, or we'll indict you again. You do what you go and let us and cooperate with our black hooded ICE agents going wherever in New York City, and we will keep you out of jail. But if you renege on our little deal, we will re-indict you. I mean, that is sort of the implicit threat, the implicit corruption that people were objecting to here. And so basically, Paul Clement recommended, and the judge agreed in a lengthy, well-written opinion, that the solution was to make the dismissal with prejudice. In other words, so that the Justice Department doesn't have leverage over Mayor Adams. Now, you know, the downside to that, obviously, is you've got this arguably corrupt mayor who's gotten a complete and total pass from prosecution because of the corruption of the Justice Department. But that's kind of where we were anyway.
Okay. Ending with the illegal news as usual.
So much illegal news. Illegal, immoral. You just can't. It doesn't stop.
All right, George, thanks as always for talking about the illegal news with me.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Emoluments to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.